are Locked On 49ers, your daily San Francisco 49ers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome to Locked On 49ers, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. It is a Monday. Brian Peacock here with you once again. We're going to get into, obviously, the Super Bowl 53. Got to review what went down there. And the dynasty continues with the Patriots, who beat the Los Angeles Rams 13-3 in a game that a lot of people hated. I didn't hate it as much as a lot of people. I didn't think it was boring like a lot of people did. I enjoy defense, too. This isn't basketball, right? This isn't the NBA. I want to see people play a little D. And I kind of like that. So we'll get into more about that and more about that Super Bowl. And it's officially fully 100% the offseason now for the NFL. So we're going to talk a little draft, a little free agency, see what's going on in the Locked On 49ers mailbag, which continues to grow. If you want to get involved in the Locked On 49ers mailbag with either just myself or with Nick on a Winky Wednesday, hit me up on Twitter at BD Peacock. You can email the show LockedOn49ers@gmail.com. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, review the podcast. We're on iTunes. We're on Spotify. We're everywhere that you can find podcasts. Tell a friend about Locked On 49ers. And if they're not a 49ers fan, let them know that their team is covered here on the Locked On Podcast Network. And if you have a smart speaker, just say, play podcast Locked On 49ers. Going forward this offseason, still going to have all kinds of great guests coming at you three or four times a week here on the podcast, and we're going to have to start doing player profiles, looking ahead at draftable prospects and doing, you know, one or two full profiles on a player, probably for the big-time prospects, just one player per episode. So I guess we'll start that at some point this week or next week. I guess we got to start with Nick Bosa, who's on most boards the number one player in the NFL draft, according to a lot of people, most people. And he was on KNBR on Friday talking about the potential for playing for the 49ers. So I'll tease that, and maybe we'll do that this week as well and start with the player profiles for the NFL draft. But today, let's talk a little bit about Super Bowl 53. And first of all, before we get into the Super Bowl, when it comes to the Super Bowl party, I would love to hear what you guys have for rules for a Super Bowl party, because it – the Super Bowl gets weird because it becomes a non-football event, which bothers me. It's really annoying if you have people over that are like trying to shush other people during a commercial because they want to hear the commercial. I don't play that. You know, it depends. You know, if you go to somebody else's house, you got to play by their rules and whatever. But if I'm having the party and I'm hosting it, it's still about the game. You can have some other people in another room watching the game on another TV or whatever and paying attention to the commercials. But for me, it's about football. So you're not going to be shushing people during the commercials. If you catch a commercial, they're corny and overdone anyways. Like, come on. When it comes to the halftime show, that's the part that really gets me, because it's always trash. It's always terrible. The TV gets muted. You can re-up your food, re-up your beverage, whatever you need to do during halftime. You're like Bill Belichick, right? Get into the game, see what happened in the first half, reevaluate your scheme for the second half of the game. That's what you should be doing during a football, a Super Bowl football party. Put on the Puppy Bowl, crank on a record of actual good music, whatever, and not watching some trash concert with like people lip syncing. It's always so bad, and I don't know why people care about it at all. It's insane. If you're at a Super Bowl party and your goal is to watch Maroon 5 at halftime, you are not only not a football fan, you're not a music fan either. So I don't understand that on any level. So for me, it's all about the ball. And with the Super Bowl, it's hard to get the other stuff out of the way sometimes. And, you know, it's fun to have fun with the commercials or have play squares or bet on stuff and, you know, whatever, have a good time. But it's still about the ball for me. And I want to pay attention to the game. I don't want people like, I don't want to be taken out of the game, because then it's, you know, the sport is the most important part to me of watching the game. So I want to be able to focus on the game a little bit and know what's going on and be in the flow of the game mentally while I'm watching this thing. And then I want to, you know, enjoy friends and food and beverages at the times when the game is not on and while the game is also on. But yeah, for me, the commercial stuff, halftime, not a fan, and that's not a part of my the Peacock Super Bowl party. You know, one narrative with Super Bowl 53 that I don't buy into is that it was a bad game or really boring or something like that. I know there was jokes about it on Twitter, and some were, you know, it's kind of funny, but it's like not, it's not actually the case for me. Like, it's okay to have a defensive football game. It wasn't like complete ugly slop fest or something like that. It wasn't like you were watching, you know, the Cardinals and Raiders in October. This is two good football teams. These two teams are playing the Super Bowl because they're good on both sides of the ball for the most part. And both defenses showed up. And I loved seeing how they schemed against each other and how things were working. And when a game is tight and it's a one-score game the entire time, that's an awesome football game because every play matters and any play could really wreck the score and change things monumentally for how the outcome of the game is going to be and how the season is going to be and who's going to be the championship of the league. You know, so I'm okay with the defensive battle. And I know it puts some people to sleep, but I don't need just all scoring all the time. But I thought it was a pretty well-played game, especially defensively, more so than a sloppy, poorly played game offensively. Goff, it did seem like, was a little bit tight. Pressure was getting to him, and the New England secondary was awesome in coverage all night. Gurley, which is one of the most insane things that a lot of people are having trouble wrapping their heads around for good reason. Gurley, AWOL again, 10 rushes, one catch. Your best player touches the ball 11 times, and everyone is claiming he's not hurt. There's got to be some mystery injury that they didn't want to let on about. Even post-game, Gurley said he's fine, had an MRI, he'll have a physical tomorrow. I got to believe he's going to have some kind of knee surgery, you know, within the week. Otherwise, none of that makes sense. You scored 3 points. What you were doing wasn't working. Give the ball to your best player and hope at least he breaks one. And he had a couple of okay runs. And so I'm sure we'll learn more about that in the coming days. But right now, everyone's saying that he's healthy and it was game flow. And he didn't – I don't get that at all. You're within one score. It was tied 3-3 or 3-0 for most of that football game. And that game script is not enough for you to use your all-pro running back. That doesn't make sense, man. Like, not at all on any level. Brady might have tightened up even a little bit after that first interception. Interception on the first play of the game, which is not unprecedented. I believe I heard after the game that Jim Kelly did that, and maybe Ron Jaworski did that. So that's not the first time that someone's thrown an interception on their first attempt. But Brady, you know, he played okay. He didn't play terrible, but I think maybe he tightened up there a little bit. I think that game plan for the Patriots was to dink and dunk. I think that was just obviously what they wanted to do all game long. And they wanted to throw it to their backs a little bit. They wanted to throw it short. Obviously, Julian Edelman was a huge part of that. And he was the target on that interception on the first play of the game for Tom Brady. And it was an awesome play. And see, here's again, this is why I think it was a fun game to watch for me. And I liked the defensive battle. And I loved seeing Belichick and Brian Flores, who hasn't gotten enough credit and wasn't really talked about much during the telecast, the Patriots defensive coordinator, who's going to move on to be the head coach of the Miami Dolphins. He called a great game, and Belichick obviously is a huge part of that defense and game planning and making any adjustments at halftime. They did a phenomenal job, but on the Rams side, they played well on defense too, and Wade Phillips put together a great game plan. And on that first play, it was awesome because that's the chess match. And that's what I love to see is that it wasn't a bad play where Brady, you know, threw a duck and it was almost picked off. Brady sees one thing and he thinks it's man. And then the Rams shift to a zone defense and Brady's thinking it's man. And you can see as he's letting go of the ball, he doesn't want to let it go because he realizes, oh no, this is a different look than what they were showing pre-snap. And he tried to pull the ball back kind of, and you did see it flutter a little bit, and it gets picked off. And by the way, Tom Brady, more picks on that one play than Joe Montana had in 4 Super Bowls, which was 0. Joe Montana, 4-for-4 in Super Bowls, never picked off. Just going to throw that out there. One thing the Pats, you know, okay, let's take a quick break here, and we'll talk more Super Bowl, and we're definitely going to get into some drafts and 49ers stuff in the last segment here on the show. Coming into Super Bowl 53, I tweeted out that I thought the MVP of the game was going to be either Tom Brady or it was going to be Aaron Donald, because Aaron Donald is a special player, probably the best defensive player in the NFL right now, and his ability to get pressure up the middle was going to be massive, because we saw the Chargers, who have a good pass rush, and the Chiefs, who have a good pass rush. Those teams weren't able to get to Tom Brady in the playoffs. And it's a little bit different look coming from the Rams, who have Ndamukong Suh next to Aaron Donald. It's very hard to double those guys, and pressure up the middle, I thought, could be something that could really affect Brady, and it's a little bit easier to maybe chip and help out on outside pass rushers as it is from guys coming right up the middle. But I thought it was really interesting, because right out of the gate, the Pats were doubling Aaron Donald, which is what Bill Belichick loves to do. Bill Belichick loves to take the opposing team's best players out of it and make things difficult and make the pedestrian guys win football games. And they did the same thing on defense, trying to stop the run. They wanted to make sure they showed big people and big personnel people. If it was awesome seeing the substitutions too, because the Rams would just make one sub on offense. They would bring in a tight end. They would bring in Higbee. And all of a sudden, the Patriots, they wouldn't bring in just one player to counteract Higbee. You put in your big tight end. To the Patriots, that means, okay, you've got big people in there. You're going to run the ball. They brought in three guys. They brought in nose tackle Danny Shelton. They brought two big defensive linemen in the game and another linebacker. And so it was a massive sub on their part just for a tight end. And I thought that was interesting. They wanted to dare Jared Goff to beat him and throw the ball and push the ball outside. And they really want to clog up the middle of the field against the Rams. And I thought that was a great – and look, the Bears earlier in the season, they gave the Rams all kinds of trouble on defense. So maybe that's the Sean McVay, Jared Goff playbook now for defenses. You've seen it multiple times here in the playoffs. This is how teams are going to go about it. And I imagine the 49ers are going to do a similar thing to try to beat Sean McVay and Jared Goff's Rams next year. But doubling Aaron Donald was big, because not only did it try to take Aaron Donald out of the game, and he was still disruptive a little bit, but that also took an extra blocker away from the guys on the edge. And the Rams were able to get around the edge a little bit, and they were able to pressure Tom Brady a little bit because there was so much focus on Aaron Donald. But it ended up not really hurting the Pats that much, although they did keep the Pats' offense at bay quite a bit. So both defenses, I thought, schemed well and maybe out-schemed their offensive counterparts. You know, as much talk as there is about Sean McVay and how much of a genius he is, I thought maybe Brian Flores and Bill Belichick out-coached Sean McVay. And I think on the other side, and they did get just enough points, but I think maybe Wade Phillips did a little bit better job than Josh McDaniels. And so to me, that was still exciting, and there was still some chess match going on there in this game, and it was still really fun to watch, even though the score was low. But, you know, points doesn't necessarily make a good football game. Pats doubling Aaron Donald was huge, surrendered some pressure elsewhere, but doing a good job on AD. At one point in that game, you thought, is the MVP, is the MVP punter Johnny Hecker? NFL record for the longest punt in a Super Bowl game. It's crazy how every single year there's like a record or multiple records that happen. This one is the lowest scoring game ever, the longest punt ever. Obviously, that, you know, it's not a huge moment. That was one of the biggest moments on Twitter, though, was the Johnny Hecker punt. But it was like, okay, 3-0 game right now. The MVP is a punter. So I can see how people would have been a little bit bored by that game. I do get that, even though to me it wasn't that way. But second half, things started to heat up. And fourth quarter, there was a lot more action. But a couple of really big plays that I think were the massive differences in this game. Third quarter, Goff had Brandon Cooks uncovered in the end zone, and he didn't see him. That is a Super Bowl. You can't win a Super Bowl, a tight Super Bowl, a one-score Super Bowl, or for the most of the game is a one-score Super Bowl. You cannot win that when you have a player in the end zone and your quarterback doesn't see him and doesn't hit him in time. And he still almost got it there in time, but Cooks is 5'8". He can't outmuscle the DB for the ball. Jason McCourty makes a great play. I think they might have been playing cover three, and somehow the center fielder was nowhere to be found on that play. I would have to go back and watch what exactly the defense was. The broadcast view didn't show it that very well, but McCourty's hanging out on the other third of the field, and he comes over. It's definitely not his play to make and his man. He comes over to knock that ball away just in time, and I think Cooks had his hands on it, and he could have pulled that in. And that's one of the caveats of having, you know, quicker, smaller receivers as your number one guy. It's more difficult for a guy like Brandon Cooks, who's 5'8", to go up and play big and make a big play on the ball. And it happened again later in the game as well. Greg Zuerlein did hit a field goal there, and that was a game tire late in the third quarter. So 3-3 late in the third quarter. Then they started to put a few more points up on the board in the fourth quarter. The game's first touchdown finally comes. Tom Brady hitting Julian Edelman, who was, at that point, you know, 10 catches for 141 yards in a game that's 3-3. It's like, okay, Edelman's the MVP of this game. There's no other option because nobody else has done anything statistically to win that award. That would end up being Edelman's last catch, though, on that drive. Then there was a dime to Gronk where they were able to hit Gronk on that seam pass, took it inside the five-yard line. That set up the Sony Michel plunge into the end zone. That gave the Patriots a 10-3 lead. And at that point, yeah, the writing was on the wall. And that was such a massive drive. And that was Brady being Brady. He dropped a dime, you know, hitting Edelman and driving the team down there, taking advantage of the Rams, who couldn't come through and who couldn't put the ball in the end zone. And you can't continually give Tom Brady those chances. And the Rams played a little conservative, punting from, I think it was the 44-yard line. And it was like, oh, okay, you're gonna punt and keep giving the ball back to these guys. The Rams just offensively didn't have that confidence. And Goff couldn't put them into the end zone, even when he had a guy standing in the end zone wide open. And I think that's really what it comes down to in this game. But what's crazy, going back to my earlier point, and what is a lot of people's points right now, is to not use Todd Gurley more often in a game that's 3-0, 3-3 through most of it, and you still can't use your stud running back to try to get something going offensively when your quarterback's obviously not putting you in the end zone. That's going to be something that haunts Rams fans, I think, for a long time. It might make 49ers fans feel a little bit better that the Rams didn't just like aren't this budding dynasty that if they win the Super Bowl this year and it's like, oh my God, are the Rams amazing and they're going to win all these Super Bowls in a row? The Rams are beatable, and I think that's been shown, and it's up to the 49ers now to be good enough to beat those Rams, and that's a lot more on that conversation as we go forward. That's pretty much what this podcast will be about for the next few months. Yeah, back to the Brandon Cooks thing. Again, later in the fourth quarter, when they really needed it, they were down. This is their last stand. This is the Rams' last drive. Try to put the ball in the end zone and tie this game up. Brandon Cooks can't come down with a nicely thrown ball by Jared Goff. It was a good play, I think. Stephon Gilmore got his hand in there a little bit, or got his hand at least on the arm of Brandon Cooks, so he couldn't go up with both hands. But again, a bigger wide receiver can go up and snatch that ball. Brandon Cooks not able to do that. And then that set up the next play, which was the YOLO ball from Goff. He just chucked it up there, and it sort of ducked on him. And Stephon Gilmore gets the interception. And he had one-on-one. Goff did. He had one-on-one. And if the pressure wasn't in his face, and it didn't allow him to step up and put that ball where he wanted to. And by the way, that's the way to beat Jared Goff and a lot of quarterbacks, but especially Goff, seeing the difference between in the numbers, what he looks like when the pocket's clean and throwing a pretty ball, and when he's got pressure. I think it's the biggest drop in the league from the numbers that I saw, from what his passer rating is and what his efficiency numbers are, going from, because everyone gets worse with pressure, but clean pocket to pressure, his drops more than anybody's in the league. And it's the way to get after a lot of quarterbacks. And so 49ers, keep getting those pass rushers, get after Jared Goff. That's going to be one of the biggest things you can do against the Rams to beat them next year and going forward. So that interception, Stephon Gilmore had his signature play in that game, and Gilmore played such a fantastic game, as did the entire defense, but that secondary. And I thought at that point, maybe Stephon Gilmore, and maybe he got robbed not getting the MVP award, because Edelman, you know, he was open underneath a lot, and he caught a lot of balls, and he put up some production offensively. but I think someone on the defense deserved to win that award. I thought the game that Gilmore played and the season he's had and then having the signature interception, I thought that might have been enough. And I still think maybe Stephon Gilmore got snubbed from the MVP award just because of how well that secondary covered Rams receivers all night and how well that defense played. Anyway, 13-3 final. New England Patriots win their sixth Super Bowl. A feather in the cap of Patriots defensive coordinator Brian Flores, who will move on to be the next head coach of the Miami Dolphins. And, of course, Bill Belichick gets ring number six. Tom Brady gets ring number six. The 49ers are now looking up at two franchises, the Steelers and the Patriots, who have won more Super Bowl titles than the 49ers five. Niners have been on the quest for six since 1995, and that will continue. Can they close that gap? Can they get there? Can they join that party of teams with six Super Bowl titles that now is the Patriots along with the Steelers? Tom Brady, by the way, also surpassing Charles Haley, now the only player to hoist six Lombardis himself. Charles Haley had five with the Niners and Cowboys. All right, it's time to take a quick break. Let's talk a little bit 49ers and got a couple of good questions to dip into on the mailbag. I want to go to my guy Kruger on Twitter because he's always great at putting things into perspective after a game. He said, Pats win past 2 weeks due to Bill Belichick's game plan on defense and a near pathetic game from Goff. Yet I suspect the media talk will be about Tom Brady. One good thing about Julian Edelman winning MVP, his place on the all-time playoff receptions is further proof of how rule changes overrate the current era. Oh, that's interesting. And like I said, I think someone from the defensive side of the ball deserved to win the MVP award, but that just doesn't happen. I thought maybe the interception, I guess it would have had to be like a pick six from Stephon Gilmore for him to get it. And there was a number of players on that Pats defense that played really well. And really the MVP of that game was Bill Belichick. We all know that. And he's the real GOAT in all of this. But Tom Brady deserves a bunch of credit. It's nice to see Julian Edelman, you know, another Bay Area guy, get that MVP award and not just give it to the quarterback. But Jerry Rice, he is not. And there's a lot of talk about Julian Edelman being a Hall of Famer, which is insane to me. He's had like 1,000-yard season, I think, maybe two at the most. The New England media is crazy, man. Like the hype that happens sometimes with the East Coast bias, I mean, that is real. And Julian Edelman, nice player, awesome career. Props to him winning the Super Bowl MVP award. It was definitely not deserved by him. It was definitely a deserved award by him, even though I thought maybe Gilmore should have got it as an award for that entire Pats defense. But I agree, Kruger. I don't think we even need further proof of how rule changes have overrated the current era, especially as far as offensive production goes. But that's what's so crazy about this game and why Bill Belichick, this is like the ultimate Bill Belichick win, because in this area with inflated stats and rules to help the offense and hurt the defense, Bill Belichick just held the Rams that had a crazy offense all season long to 3 points. And even the Rams defense holding the Patriots to 13 is really good. If you came into this game and said, hey, the Patriots are going to score 13, you would put all your money on the Rams winning that game. So that's what was amazing about this. And that's why I kind of liked it. A lot of people were put to sleep by it, thought it was a boring game. I kind of like that about it. Like they said, okay, this is the way the league is going. Well, not tonight, because we are going to snuff out the other team's offense and they're not going to put up these crazy stats and these crazy points. But even in a game like that, 13-3, you have one guy who catches 10 balls for 141 yards just because it's like over and over exploiting this one thing, right? And so if there's one thing the Rams did not do well enough, it's take away that one aspect of the Pats offense that they weren't able to corral that slot receiver getting loose on those double move routes, those little option routes or whatever you want to call them. But then again, that's what's so awesome about Brady and the Pats offense and how well they all work together and they know what's going on. When the Pats do come up and try to stop that finally, then now you have Gronk and like, boom, you hit him over the seam and gouge him for a big, even bigger play than, you know, than the Edelman 8-yarder. So you're kind of damned if you're due and you're damned if you don't when a team is balanced and can go a lot of different ways with the ball. And the Pats ability to run the ball, I think, with Sony Michel is a big factor here, too. And that's something that's going to really help out this team going forward and help out Tom Brady if he indeed does intend to play until he's 45. Okay, let's get into some draft stuff real quick here. Let's go to Kieran's question. He says, lots of teams talk about trading up for a quarterback, but isn't it just as likely someone like the Raiders will trade up for Bosa? And if so, should we try to swap with Arizona? And if Bosa is available at two, what price would we be willing to accept, if any, to pass on Bosa? As far as the price from trading down from two, I think that makes it a little bit more difficult. So I think you can hold strong a little bit more. If you're the 49ers and Bosa is there and you're on the clock at two, I think that makes it a lot easier to say no to a trade offer. Whereas if it was Bosa one, Quinnen Williams two, even though maybe on your draft board, those two overall talent-wise, there's not a big separation there or any separation at all between Bosa and Quinnen. The need is not there for Quinnen, so maybe then you're like, okay, we will take this offer that maybe we would have said no, even though it's a pretty good offer to. But it's hard to say what you would accept. It really depends on how far you're moving down, which team is actually doing the offering. As far as the 49ers trading up, John Ledyard of the Draft Network and Locked On NFL Draft, he dropped a mock draft earlier this week or last week or whenever that was, and he had the 49ers trading up to number one to draft Bosa from the Cardinals. The obvious problem there being that it's a division rival and those kind of trades just don't happen very often. So that's a difficult part of making a trade like that happen. And the other thing is for the 49ers, they don't have a lot of draft capital to use this year. They're down a couple of picks. They only had five coming in. I think they're going to get a sixth pick for a compensatory, but that's not going to be, you know, a high pick. It's going to be a day three pick. So they don't have a lot of ammo. And for the 49ers, it just makes more sense to sit back and wait at number two to see if Bosa is there and make the Cardinals make that decision, because maybe the Cardinals would still take a different guy anyway. So you've got to make them make that decision first, then hang back, and then maybe try to trade out of there from number two. But going up for Bosa, I just think what it costs to move up one spot, it won't be that cheap. And especially it won't be cheap because you're dealing with a division rival, even if they are willing to trade with you, which might not be the case at all anyway. You lose out on the opportunity to just have Bosa fall to you, because obviously if a team like the Cardinals is willing to drop down one spot, they know who you're trading up for, so they must not care that much about Bosa, so maybe they wouldn't draft him at all if that's the case. Maybe it would be more likely that someone like the Raiders does move up and try to take Bosa, although is that worth it because there's so many good pass rushers in the draft, and maybe they have a guy who's worth taking at number four even if Bosa doesn't fall to them? Maybe there's a team that really loves Quinnen Williams and they want to move up with the 49ers and take him. Maybe that would be the Raiders. Maybe that would be anybody. So, and obviously there's the quarterback talk. So there's a lot of different reasons a team could trade, but the cost is usually so high in the draft to be swapping picks in the top five that, and especially if you're coming from outside of the top five up, that it's cost prohibitive unless you think you're getting yourself a franchise quarterback. One more question that's been in the queue since last week. Josh wants to know, thoughts on Wes Welker coming in as a wide receiver coach? Would he help incorporate some wide receiver concepts Jimmy G is used to from New England? And yeah, it's hard to say that that wouldn't be a nice thing to have for Jimmy Garoppolo and how well he played when things were a little bit stripped down and maybe they were using some concepts at the end of 2017 that he was used to playing in New England. And maybe they are trying to incorporate a little bit more of that in San Francisco if they did hire a guy like Wes Welker to be the wide receiver coach. So for a lot of reasons, it does make sense for the 49ers to try to hire Wes Welker. And, you know, he's a crafty, scrappy guy. Those guys always make for good coaches. And I think that would be sort of a signal of what they might be trying to incorporate a little bit more of, especially when you consider the kind of receivers they have on the roster and the quarterback they have in Jimmy Garoppolo. You could sort of tie that all in together if the 49ers indeed do make that hire. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Locked On 49ers. Keep those mailbag questions coming in to me at BDPeacock on Twitter or email LockedOn49ers@gmail.com. Go to LockedOn49ers.com to find not only the podcast, but some other off-season draft and free agency articles. And I will be back tomorrow right here on Locked On 49ers.